Yeah, so she takes one look at the sore and says, you got to get to a herpetologist.
Yeah, I mean, a herpetologist? I've never heard of that before.
Yeah.
What the heck is a...
Well, this is my lizard. It had a sore on its mouth. And a herpetologist is an expert on reptiles.
Oh, because I thought you meant... I see. Oh, wait a minute. Hey, we're rolling.
Oh, well, then let's roll. Well, he's Mark.
And he's Rich.
And we are
two guys on Block Island. All right, ladies and gentlemen, today we have a guest who is probably one of the nicest guys. Rich, am I wrong in saying that he's probably one of the most well-liked people on this island, I would have to say,
roundly? I think so.
I think he's the kind of guy that would just... He'd give you the shirt off his
back. He's a helper.
He'll a fantastic help anybody out. Dude. Yeah. Wears a lot of hats.
We'll give his number out, so if you need any help with anything,
yeah, you just give him a shout.
Yeah, just
anyways,
text him.
Of course, we're talking about your friend of mine, Dave Sniffin. Dave, how's it going, man?
Great. How are you guys doing?
We're doing all right.
Yeah, we're doing good. Better now that you're here.
Yeah.
Thanks for taking some time out of your busy schedule.
Yeah, no problem. It's raining today, so there's not a lot to do.
Yeah.
Well, that's all right, then. That's good.
Hopefully, we'll help pass a few rainy hours, at least. All right, Dave. So the first question we ask all of our guests, basically, the big question is, when did you first come to Block Island? How did you get here? How'd you hear about it? And what made you stay, kind of thing?
Well, my grandfather was actually a fisherman, part-time fisherman. He lived in Connecticut in Westport, and he would come out to Block Island to fish. He had his own boat, and he was a sword fisherman. He actually went and harpooned swordfish. And did some other fishing as well, but one of his big things was harpooning swordfish
back in the day when Block Island swordfish was actually Block Island swordfish.
Absolutely.
There was still swordfish around to harpoon.
Yeah.
Yeah. We had Dickie Stinson on as a guest, and I wonder if they knew each other back then.
They did. They would harpoon, not together, but they would in a fleet.
Yep. Okay.
So my family's been out here for many, many years.
Did your grandfather live here? No.
He didn't leave her full time, but he did purchase two separate houses. One of them my mother still lives in, and one my cousin Karen Carlone lives in.
Okay.
And so I came out here as a very young child, probably several months old. We would come out just at the beginning of my youth, just for vacations. But after a couple of years, I have five older sisters, and they all started getting jobs out here and working out here, and that's how they would, make money for college. So we would come out and spend the summers on Block Island.
And
five older sisters.
We both back did up the same thing. Hold on. Are you the only male in the family?
Correct.
Oh.
Wow. What was that youngest? Like growing up?
You know what? I didn't know any different.
Right.
I didn't think it was weird.
Yeah.
But, I mean, it's
great. Not weird, but,
I didn't know any different. And it was great,
Yeah.
And my oldest sister is 12 years older than me. By the time I was, 8 or so, she was off to college, and she'd been off to college. So, but I didn't notice any, it was just normal to me.
Yeah. It's all a matter of,
And I like growing up in a big family. Big families are great.
So. Yeah.
And so 12 years, so you pretty good run of, every 2 years, another kid added to the family.
Right, right.
Yeah,
I always say they kept going until they got it right. So.
Yes, indeed. So,
or you were an accident. One of the two.
So did you, when you guys would come visit, you stayed with your grandparents at the house?
Correct. They had two houses, but the one they lived in predominantly was right behind the spring house. And, we would stay there for the few weeks, and then eventually my sisters started working out here, so we would come out for the summer. So I spent all my, from probably, I can't remember exactly when, but probably 6 or 7 years old, all the way through every summer out here.
Yeah.
When I turned 14, I started working at the Atlantic as a dishwasher, and then worked my way up in the kitchen there, and was eventually one of the cooks in there until through the summer of 89. And then the Atlantic was sold.
Who owned the Atlantic in those days?
Vin Ryan.
That was when Vin had it.
Right.
How was Vin to work for?
He was great.
Pretty awesome.
You know what's amazing to me? I worked for him back in the 80s. And if I see him at the post office or anytime I've seen him, he remembers me, knows my name, says hello when we talk. I was our group of friends from that time are still very close, but I was friends with his daughters at that worked yeah. there and everything. So it was a great time. You know, I learned a lot in that time. I worked under a chef by the name of Bob Nooney, which I don't know if anybody remembers him, but Bobby Townsend was there when I worked there, and Bobby Townsend was pretty, you know, well known on the island. That was a great time. I learned a lot.
Who else was your crew? Who are the people you used to hang out with?
Mike O'Brien was a bartender at the Atlantic. Vin McElmoon worked at the Atlantic when I was there. Mark Emanuel worked at the Atlantic when I was there. You know, that kind of group. There's yeah. still some people still around
yeah.
who remember that. Trip Pierce took over and did a cafe out back called the Cafe Deja Vu. And
I remember that.
Do you?
Yeah, yeah. Yeah.
We did things like, because Trip Pierce had a place called Tiffany's, which was where the old hardware store was, which is now
Lazy Fish.
Yep. Yeah. Yeah. And Trip Pierce did, you know, burritos and things like that, a little cafe food. And we did that at the Atlantic one year in the cafe. I ran that for a year. That was great. And you know, that's kind of, I really just started just to make money to help with college education, help my parents with college education. And I didn't know it was going to kind of turn into my first career.
Where'd you go to school?
I went to school in North Carolina at North Carolina State University.
What'd you study down there?
I was in zoology program, pre-med zoology. I got a degree in that. And then I went back to school in the mid-90s and got my high school science teaching degree. So I have a degree in secondary education and biology and general science.
Yeah. Yeah.
Wicked smart.
Wicked but, smart. Dave's one of the most wicked smart people I know.
And then sorry, you go first.
No, not at all.
So when you said you're pre-med for...
Well, it was pre-med, pre-dental, and pre-veterinary. It was that program.
Okay, but all veterinary is what you were thinking at
I was thinking
time.
I might go into veterinary school, but then I graduated college and didn't really want to go in that direction. I like animals, but I had a hard time with them in pain. It was just difficult for me, and that's not good for a vet. So...
Yeah.
Right.
I decided, you know, go back, maybe become a teacher, and I got my degree. But the sad part about that is that the industry that I was in as a chef in the industry, I was making a lot more money than a teacher would make. And I was working a lot less, you know, I was working a lot of hours when I worked, but it was, you know, 4, 5, 6 months out of the year, 7 months out of the year.
So did you so you had a passion for animals. When did the animal thing start with you? Ever since you were a kid?
Since I was a kid.
So you're just fascinated with animals.
Yeah. I would always be the kid who would be out in the woods picking up rocks and catching things. And, you know, out here I did a lot of snorkeling and spearfishing, but also catching lobsters and things like that. That was kind of like my thing was like, I'd go snorkeling every day and see different fish, spearfish or catch creatures. And that's what it's always been that way.
Yeah. So it's widely known that you are the reptile guy on Block Island, right?
Right.
I mean, would that be fair to say?
Sure. I'd take that title.
Yeah. I mean, tell us about your pets.
Well, I've always been interested in animals and reptiles in particular, and I'd always had them as pets, but the funny thing, my father was never a big snake guy. I didn't like him at all, but he never discouraged me, which was amazing. He never, you know, told me I couldn't or shouldn't or anything like that when snakes are concerned. And but he did say one thing when you have your own house, you can get whatever you want. But when you're living under my roof, you're not going to buy that python or that lizard or anything. So really,
we only have one bathtub.
Yeah, I you know, I've had a lot of pets in the past. And then in 1996, I purchased a little tortoise through the mail, came to me, weighed 4 ounces. And now 27 years later, he's weighs about 100 pounds, 120 pounds. He's a giant tortoise from Africa. And that was kind of like the start of it. I'd always had a pet here or there in college. I did a lot of collecting in college. I was in North Carolina. I would collect a lot of reptiles out in the woods and everything. And my roommates didn't love it. But they weren't happy.
Where did you keep them?
I had aquariums in our apartment, and once in a while, something might escape, and slither across their foot. They were not happy.
And one,
it happens.
I brought a copperhead home for one time. For
Wait, those are poisonous.
Yeah, venomous. Yeah,
only if they bite you.
Yeah, only if you get bitten. And I had that for a while. And that
in the apartment.
Oh yeah, yeah, yeah. But you know, if you're careful and you take the right, you know, you make sure it's caged properly, it's fine.
Wow.
So I've always been interested. And then when I got moved into my house out here in 2008. I started accumulating reptiles. I had a 16-foot python that passed away a couple years ago, but I have a new python now that's about 7 feet, but we'll get up to about 16 feet.
Yeah.
And I've got a boa constrictor that's about 8 or 9 feet. I've got like 8 snakes. I've an alligator snapping turtle and some soft-shelled turtles. I got a giant African bullfrog that eats mice. That's pretty cool. I've got a salamander. I've got a lavender king snake, which is really cool, albino snake. I've got 2 scaleless snakes. It's a genetic anomaly of this rat snake that it doesn't have scales, so that's kind
of
crazy.
So what is it?
All of them, or just you got a special one?
It's a genetic defect in the Texas rat snake that it doesn't have scales on its skin. Not all of them. Most of them in the wild look normal, but this one they found one that was deficient of a gene, and they bred for it. So now you can purchase a snake with no scales.
So what does that look like? I mean, it just looked like a smooth snake,
like skin. Yeah,
so it doesn't have to shed.
It does shed, but it sheds skin. It's skin, but it's not like coverings of the scales. It's just like smooth skin. It's weird. It's wild.
And your tortoise is named, of course,
Elvis.
Now you're talking about a lifelong investment with a tortoise, right?
At least,
yeah.
Well, I mean, I don't think he can live 100, 125 years. And I got him, he was born in 1996. So I don't think I'm going to make it that far. I'm going to have to will him to family members or something.
Yeah. But. Yeah.
And the same with the snapping turtle?
Yeah. Yeah. This was a small turtle. It was probably about 4 ounces when I got him. Now he's about 14, 15 inches, probably weighs 10, 12 pounds. But they get up to 200 pounds and they're big. They can get big. So,
oh, yeah.
Yeah. That's something. Yeah, I'll leave to my nieces and nephews to deal with.
Yeah. What's that turtle's name?
What's the name of the snapping turtle in Mario Brothers? Bowser?
Oh, yeah.
Bowser?
I think Bowser.
Bowser, yeah.
Sometimes I let a lot of the island kids like to come look at the animals, and sometimes I let them pick the names for them. And I think that's the one they settled on.
In the python that passed away, sorry to hear that, by the way. Was that Priscilla?
That was Priscilla.
Now, did you name Priscilla Presley? Was it because of Priscilla Presley?
Yes.
So you had Elvis and Priscilla.
Yeah. And now my new python's name is Lisa Marie.
Fantastic.
I heard a story, and I don't know if it's a fable, but I heard that they had a snapping turtle, like what would you say, an alligator snapping turtle, something like that, in a zoo, and it finally passed away. It lived out its life. So they did a necropsy on it. Is that what you call it?
Right, an autopsy on an animal.
On an animal, necropsy. And they actually found a musket ball in it from the Civil War.
Absolutely.
Like, what?
Like it was because they would shoot them and eat them because they were all starving during the Civil War. So apparently this one got shot, but it wasn't a fatal injury, and it went on living another 80 years with a musket ball.
Yeah.
Wow.
Inside
It's amazing they can live, how long they can live, and if just left alone to their own devices, they survive anything pretty much, you know. You'd find them with, like, missing feet. Alligators are the same way. They get a limb torn off in a fight, but they can live, you know, 100 years, and they're tough.
Really?
Wow.
Well, they're the closest thing to dinosaurs, right?
But, right.
You know.
Yeah. So, I mean, I would imagine that this is not an inexpensive hobby to maintain reptiles like that.
Yeah, I have to keep the heat. They have a lot of heating devices and pumps and things like that. Feeding them's not that much.
What's your electric bill a month?
Electric bill's high. But I justify it in a lot of ways. One of them is that I don't have a lot of vices. You know, and I'm not out spending my money on, you know, going out to dinner or partying all night or spending all, you know, and I don't have any kids. So I don't spend my money on, I spend it on my hobby. That's what I spend
it. You don't have to justify anything, by the way.
No, thank
you. If you like doing it, you're happy. Just do it. You know, if you enjoy it.
It's not cheap, but it's something I enjoy.
So. Well, as you said, you also a lot of the island kids come over and they get to learn about these animals,
right?
And so it's like you're providing a. It's almost like you have. I mean, you do have a bit of a zoo in a sense, you know, which is. Between your house and Abrams Farm up there, it's like when you think about it, we're pretty lucky to have that kind of biodiversity here to check out.
I started a little tradition when I moved into my house where on Halloween, our neighborhood,
you let all the snakes out.
No, that would be funny. the West Side 20, the neighborhood gets inundated with kids. It's a great place for trick or treating, and a lot of kids come through. And
it's a must stop.
Right.
It's a must stop.
Exactly. Yeah. And so I invite every kid that comes to the house to go. This sounds kind of weird. I invite kids to go down into my basement.
Mm-hmm. Check out
if
my
if you
snake
want
collection.
Candy.
Come and see. But, you know, with their parents, of course.
Of course.
Oh, yeah.
Jakeson Hall has, since 2008, always volunteers to spend Halloween evening at my house handing out candy so I can give the kids a tour of the basement, and they come down and, you know, they can see all the snakes. And I keep getting new snakes here and there. And, you know, as ones pass on, I get new ones. So it's ever changing. And so Halloween's coming up. I think I'm going to get a good basement tour coming up. And
now, do you dress the snakes in costumes for? Is there like a theme for, like, do you have dress them all like soldiers 1 year and then like, you know, priests the next?
You know, they don't really enjoy getting dressed up.
Not
I tried
so
it. They don't.
Yeah, it's hard to keep the outfits on them because they don't have appendages.
Right,
like arms
just slither right through.
Yeah, slither right out of them.
Oh my God! Well, it makes me want to go trick or treating at Dave's house.
I've never
seen the collection.
You're welcome anytime.
I have a request though. If you ever do decide to put costumes on this, could you at least make four of them the members of KISS? You know,
paint their faces
just,
and everything.
Yeah, just throwing it out.
All right,
there.
That'll be challenging, be cool. But I can do it. I'll give it my best shot.
But like, so science is just generally speaking for you. I feel like science is something. You're a science guy. Like some people are like, you know, oh, they read books, they're English majors, they're into poetry, whatever. You're a science guy.
I'm a science guy, definitely, yeah.
Because one of the other things I really want to dive in with you is that, you know, right now, craft beer is huge. It's an explosion, right? And I think back in the 80s, it was kind of becoming this little home thing where you could get I had one. I think you had one, Rich. You know, I definitely made a batch of beer in my life. But you actually, Dave, started one of the very first brew pubs, I'd say, in New England, probably.
We were the third licensed brewery in Rhode Island back in the mid-90s. It all started from home brewing.
Can you segue us or carry us from the Atlantic to?
Yeah, let's
then
you do went, that.
Then you did the. Then you got your. You were going to school to become a teacher.
Right. Well, so Atlantic was sold in after the 89 season, and I didn't know when it was going to open. I had just graduated college in 1990 in May, and I needed a job. So I was walking along. I was on Block Island. Walking along the street, and I saw a new restaurant opening up where the Block Island Broiler had been, and it was called Mohegan Cafe. So I went inside. They hadn't really opened yet. I went inside, and I met up with one of the manager at the time was Cheryl Shea, and she was married to the chef there, Chuck Eckert. And I came in, and I said, I'm looking for a job. I've worked in a kitchen for the last 8 years. I'm pretty experienced. And they said, do you have housing? And I said, yeah, I have housing. And they said, you're hired.
Yeah, I was going to say.
So
it's usually how it works.
I spent 2 days on the fry station at the Mohegan Cafe. And then they said, you're going to work on the broil station. And I spent 4 years at the broil station until the head chef that was there for a year just decided not to come back. And then the owner, Mike Finnemore, said, can you be the head chef guy? And I said, I'll try.
Yeah.
And that was it.
It worked out all right.
Mike has a good way of doing that. Hey, can you do this? And you're like, I don't think so, but maybe. He's like, yeah, okay, well, just you're doing that now.
And that's how the brewery came about. I was a home brewer. I had become fascinated with that because in college, one of my housemates, Heidi Ernst.
Oh, really?
Wait, okay. What? You went to college with Heidi?
We lived in the same house in Bonnet Shores.
Oh, okay.
And
I thought you meant North Carolina.
No, this was in URI.
Gotcha.
And she'd been delving into home brewing, and I thought it was really cool. This was when it was all coming out, and everybody had the kits and everything. So I had been brewing for a couple of years, home brewing, and then I was in the Mohegan on my half a day off. And
yeah, I was gonna say, if I recall, you really did the max hours compared to even, you know, I was running Finn's Kitchen, and I, you know, you just were there all
it was a lot.
The time.
It was a lot.
How long was the work week? How many hours? 80?
80 to 100 in the peak.
Yeah.
Oh, you know, it
brutal.
Was, you know, 12 to 14 hour days most of the time. If it's in the peak, you know, in the off season, it was better.
Yeah.
But that was just I didn't know any differently. That was just the business. But, and that's why one of the reasons I got out over time, it just, you know, you get to a certain point, you can't do it anymore.
It's right? A young man's game.
Yeah. Yeah.
And it was fun and great. I had the greatest time, met the greatest people, but
I love the restaurant business, but you just get to a point.
Physically, you can't do it.
And you know, let's enjoy a weekend. Or a night.
Well, you then know? You get maybe some new owner who's an asshole. And it's like, let's get out of this. Yeah, beat it. Yes.
Oh, I see.
I don't think that's what happened. But.
No, I know. I'm kidding. Dave and I worked together when I owned the Mohegan, and it, you know, I can attest to the number of hours Dave put in, because he was, I mean, you were the go-to guy. It was like, we, you know, when we took it over, it was like a turnkey thing, and Dave was just, I'd never run a restaurant. I was like, Dave, what do we do? And he's like, we're just going to keep doing what we've been doing. Then we're like, great, let's go.
Yeah.
And it worked.
Yeah, yeah. It just, physically, I wasn't able to do it ever. When, you know, you get into your, when you're coming up to 50, you know, and you're like, physically, I was like breaking down. So that's why I got out of the business of that.
Good move.
But so that's basically, I was in the Mohegan washing out all my equipment, my beer brewing equipment. I was going to make a batch of homebrew, and Mike Finnemore walked by and said, what are you doing? And I said, I'm getting ready to brew some beer. And he said, could we do that here? And I said, I think so. We could try. And that's basically how that started. He went and did some research, got...
Sounds like that was your answer to most of Mike Fenmore's questions. Right.
Yeah.
I think so.
I think so. I can try.
I give it a try.
And
what's the worst that can happen?
It was the licensing for the brewery was the craziest thing, because like it wasn't that well known back then.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And you had to get a state license, you had to get a federal license, and you had to get a local license. And I believe they still have the local license was a brewer's manufacturer's license. It was like a liquor license, but allowed you to brew.
Yeah.
And I think they've kept that license. The federal license was crazy. You had to have a functional brewery before they would come and inspect it. So it was a bit of a gamble. And the feds would come out. They had four guys from the Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, and Firearms come out. They wanted to see the brewery. And
what was your setup consist? What did the setup consist of?
It wasn't really that large. It was in a small room. I was able to brew about, I could brew 300 gallons of beer at a time. It was just a fermenting vessel and a heating vessel, and it wasn't that big. It wasn't that complex.
Yeah.
But the ATF, all they wanted to know about was, just like the federal government, all they wanted to know about was when it goes from the room where it's being stored into refrigeration, it becomes a taxable item.
Right.
You owe us $3.50 on each barrel that, you know.
Yeah.
That was their big concern, and they had to meet up in Providence in front of the liquor board for a state license, and that was fine. And you know, Mike had his lawyer there, and we just talked to them and asked for the license, and it was granted. And the same with the local license. You know, the fire department came and checked it out to make sure it was safe.
Yeah.
And so it was a lot of steps, but after that, it was just kind of like
rinse and repeat,
brew different beers.
And again, it was such a novelty at that time. Like there's breweries everywhere now.
Right.
Everywhere you look, there's breweries popping up all over the place. But at that time it was, and what was your, you know, your flagship beer? Did you have one or two? Cause you experimented, you did a lot of cool stuff.
I did probably 20 or 30 different beers, probably more than that. I would do like a chili pepper ale. I did, you know, different different beers. I modeled one after a Bass Ale, and it was called the Block Island Striper Ale, Stripe Bass Ale. Yeah.
I like that one.
Yeah.
The one that I think probably got the most interest and the most press about, it was in the New York Times and everything, and it was a beer called Joe's How I Got Fired Ale.
Can we tell the story?
Yeah,
this is a good story. We don't have to name any last names, no. Of course.
I was working at the Mohegan. One of our employees was a lunch cook. And I was getting ready to make beer, and I just kind of off the cuff said, "Hey Joe, what kind of beer should I make? What do you think I should make?" And he scratched his head for a second. He goes, "Well, why don't you make one of those high octane beers?" And I'm like, "What?" And he goes, "Yeah, like high octane, you know, a lot of alcohol,
8.5%."
Yeah. I'm like, "Huh." So I did a little research on it, found a recipe that I thought would be good, and made this beer. And it was very high in alcohol. It was probably 9% alcohol. And a very dark beer. And
those are tricky. I've been tricked by those.
So trickiness of that is a pint of that beer is got enough, as much alcohol as 2 pints of a regular beer.
Yeah.
But you drink it in the time it takes you to drink a pint. So you're getting 2 pints into you. Yeah.
You are getting drink, doubly drunk.
Right. Yeah. It's like 3 cans of Bud Light in one glass.
Yeah. So, you know, it was fermented and put in kegs, and it was aged for like 3 weeks, 3-4 weeks, and it was coming around. And then I decided, okay, I'm going to put it on tap and see what it's like. And Joe, I said to Joe, I made your beer for you. You got to try it. So he, at the end of the shift, went out and got one for the shift drink. And then he drank another, and then he drank another, and then he drank another, and then he drank another. Now, I think he had 6 pints,
which is actually 12.
Case of beer.
In that short amount of time. And he got home. He was living at the Highview, and he went home. And I thought everything was good. I wake up the next morning. I get into work. I'm putting the kitchen together. Joe's supposed to be there. We're supposed to be getting the kitchen set up. And
Joe's not there.
Joe doesn't show up. Joe's not there. I get the whole kitchen set up. We're open at 11:30. It's 11 o'clock. I'm like, all right, the kitchen's set up. I got to go find Joe. So I get in my car. I drive up to the Highview. I go to his room, bang on the door. I hear this kind of pitiful moan from the side. So I took that as come in. So I went in. He was not in good shape. He was definitely not in good shape.
Hurting.
Yeah. And I said, Joe, let's go. We got to get to work.
Got to sweat it out.
Yeah. And he's like, and I wasn't going to give him a pass on this one. I wasn't going to be like, yeah, you did this to yourself. So I said, let's go. And he's like, yeah. I said, no, we got to go now. Get dressed and go down. So I made him get up, get dressed while I waited at his doorway. And then we went down and went to work and kind of working. He was kind of useless. And then I noticed he like disappeared into the walk-in freezer for a good 4 or 5 minutes. And at this point in time, the owner, Mike Finnemore, is there and we're talking. And Joe walks out with, opens the door of the freezer, and this huge cloud of smoke comes out, and he walks past me, and he just reeks of weed. And I'm like, and Mike looks at me like, you're going to do something about this? So I'm like, I go over, I'm like, Joe, just go home. I don't even want to deal with this. Just go home. So Joe went home.
Again.
He got to there, and at the time, the owner of the Highview was Eddie Barube. And they had a party that night. The staff, the employees had a party in... Joe shows up, and Eddie had gotten all the rest of the crew up to clean because they'd left the mess in the hallways and the bathrooms and stuff. So Joe shows up, goes into his room. Ed goes and says, "Ed, hey, Joe, come on, get cleaning." And Joe's like, no, man, I'm off the clock. And Ed goes, "You're off the clock. You're out of here. You get out of here. You don't have any housing.
You're also out of your housing. Yeah.
Yeah, you're out of housing." So at this point, you know, Joe's, you know, I wasn't going to hire him back. I was just going to let him go. It was the end of the season. I was going to let him go. But then Eddie kicks him out of the housing. He's gone.
Yeah.
So I'm like, all right, see you, Joe.
So Joe imploded quite miraculously.
So two things happened after that that were very interesting to me. One is that I got a call from unemployment that he was requesting unemployment, and they wanted the story behind why he was fired, why he was let go.
Did you tell him it was your fault because of that beer you made?
Yes.
I told him that he didn't show up for work. When he came into work, he was caught. At this time, weed was illegal.
Yeah.
And, you know, he was smoking weed on the job, And it can be a huge liability in a restaurant.
Well, sure. Yeah.
So then the unemployment people were like, did you give him any warnings? And I'm like, for using illegal drugs on the job? And they're like, no, for being late. And I'm like, I didn't fire him for being late. He fired him for, you know, smoking weed on the job. It was and being late and being an idiot.
And he has nowhere to live.
So a couple of days later, we get word back that his unemployment had been approved. And
of
he was,
course, yeah.
So then, like, 2 or 3 weeks later, I see him. He was out of Mock Island. He was at Yellow Kittens. And he comes up to me, and he's all apologetic. He's like, yeah, man, I just want to say it's my bad. I was an idiot. I'm sorry and everything. And then he says, but to be fair, you didn't give me enough time to get high before work.
Well, so, yes, Dave, it's your fault.
So, again, it's my fault. For making the beer. Yeah. And then for not giving him enough time to get high before he came into work.
So you named the beer after him.
So we changed that, the high octane ale, to Joe's How I Got Fired High Octane Ale. And it was, you know, it was one of our most popular beers. And you know, it was great. It was a good beer. And you know, the New York Times actually wrote a little blurb on it and called me about it and get that same story. Which,
wow. So you were in the Times.
Yeah. Yeah.
New York Times.
And so was Joe. Yeah.
That's his big claim to fame. I still like the guy. I'm friends with him on Facebook. I don't hold anything ill will against him. But
well, that's the other thing about the restaurant that I learned, you know, and being in the bar business. It's like, look, you're, as you know, these seasons are so intense. They're like you're in a pressure cooker. Everyone's in it, and emotions get high sometimes. You know, when we worked together, I mean, we always got along, I felt. There were certainly moments where, you know, you and I disagreed on things, but at the end of the day, you know, again, certain cases excluded, like, it's just part of the job. Like, you're going to get stressed out. You're going to have these little moments. But at the end of the day, you're all on the same team, and you have those days. You know,
Rich, you were in the business for a long time. Oh, you know, Rich, there was some, you know, there's so many crazy stories about employees. It's just the nature of the beast. But, you know,
the restaurant is like it's like a puzzle with no uniform pieces. And if you can somehow, you know, get the pieces to fit together to make a team, that's great. And that's what you try to do, basically. And I used to say more than half my job was you know, especially like Finn's, where I didn't have much control over hires. It was basically, here's your new, you know, guy. Half the battle was keeping the team playing as a team. You know, the food would happen. If everybody played as a team, the food would happen. But it's, you know, you get one or two screwballs and things can get nuts.
Again, really, and that's kind of the nature of that job and those employees. There are a lot of transients, a lot of people from coming from different locations and looking for work. And I mean, I've had guys taken off the line in handcuffs. You've had, you know, it's kind of par for the course, and you just try to make it through. You know, I had a guy who would, his first night of work, he was awesome. And then his second night, he started putting cooking wine in his coffee to get through the night, and, you know, was passed out drunk by the end of the shift. You had to go, go and remove him, you know.
I think I hired him.
He probably worked for everybody before.
Yeah, I'm pretty sure. Yeah.
But like you said earlier about, you know, Joe giving you the excuse, right? What do you say? Oh,
I didn't give him time.
You didn't get time. You didn't give me time to get high before. You didn't, you know, oh, this or that. Like, I felt like when I exited the restaurant business, I felt like, and you know, again, I hate to sound like some grumpy old man, like slagging on millennials or whatever, but like the attitude of the younger generation that was coming in and getting jobs, it was like they'd show up 15 minutes late for work, and you're like, you're 15 minutes late. And they're like, yeah, so? They couldn't, like, literally didn't understand. They're like, but we don't open for four. I'll get all my side work done. It's like, that's not the point. Like, that's just, you know, it is. It's gotten tougher.
And it also get tough out here because, like you said, the golden resume said, hi, my name is Robert. I have housing.
Right.
You're hired.
You know?
You know, then you get to maybe, once they're in there, you're like, all right, have you ever cooked before? Right,
yeah. That's stuff you can teach, but you know, the housing's.
Yeah, exactly. That's,
yeah, you know. But I think, you know, I don't want to put down the restaurant business because I made a livelihood out of it and I enjoyed it, but it's getting harder and harder. And then with COVID, really put a wrench in the works. It's just harder and harder. The prices are higher. The prices keep going higher. It's harder and harder to make a living. I empathize with the owners now who are dealing with this, all of this, and it's hard to find good help, It's the prices are skyrocketing. You have to put your menu prices high. And what people don't realize about Block Island, and your prices have to be at a certain point because you're paying premiums for so many other things.
Shipping
besides
and
electricity, water, sewer. Yeah. Yeah. It's hard to explain why an order of chicken wings is $16.
Yep.
And you're only making $1.50 off of it. Yep. Like they really, think so.
So it's tough. And that I love to go out to eat at a restaurant, but I always feel like when I get there that it's so much money. And then I just feel bad about how much it costs. And,
that's one thing being in the restaurant business is that you never eat at a restaurant the same way ever again. No, once you get in. No. Yeah. Like when Katie and I would go out to dinner, we'd always be like, oh, what's their point of sale system? Oh, what kind of, they've got their,
you hear the table up over there out of your talking. But like I said, it's hard to make money.
Yeah.
Hey, speaking of making money, can we take a quick break for our sponsors? We're going to take a quick break, Dave. Listen to our sponsors. We'll be right back.
Hey, Rich, do these bell bottoms make me look fat?
Bell bottom. Oh, wait, it must be Monday and you're going to disco night at Captain Nick's.
Well, yeah, of course I'm going to disco night at Captain Nick's. I'm the DJ, man. I got to be there.
That place is so much fun.
So much fun. And the fun doesn't end after Monday, because on Tuesday and Wednesdays, we have dueling pianos followed by Dr. Wes Chesterton's Sloppy Seconds.
What are Sloppy Seconds?
Well, that's when I play the piano for the rest of the drunk people there at the end of the night.
Oh, that sounds fun in itself. And Thursdays, they've got live acoustic acts and full bands and DJs.
Yeah. And Friday and Saturday afternoons, we have acoustic acts on the deck at 5:30. Fridays are Delaney, and then Saturdays are buddy Rob Davis.
And then Friday and Saturday nights, they've got the best live bands on Block Island, like Derek and the Fun Bags, the Blushing Brides, Fever, Neil and the Vipers, West End Blend, and the High and Mighty Brass Band, just to name a few.
Yeah, and the bands aren't over just because Friday and Saturday night ends. On Sunday afternoons, the Young Guns take the stage on the deck at 5:30. If you want to check out the full entertainment schedule, let's just head over to Captain Nick's. BI.com. Hey, Rich, I feel like I need some exercise. Let's go run the Block Island Triathlon.
I'm more into low impact. How about a gentle paddle?
Oh, sure. Well, we could go explore the Great Salt Pond on a kayak or paddleboard from Ford Island Kayaks.
Yeah, they have the Hobie paddleboards, too. You ever try one of those out? It's like a bike on water.
I've heard about that. They've also got the Peekaboo Glass Bottom Kayak.
Yeah, and you can rent all their stuff by the hour, or half day, full day, or even a whole week. If you're going to stay for a week, you can reserve a kayak for a week.
Yeah, but you know what? You might want to make a reservation if your group is six or more. That's a hot tip for you.
Well, that's a good tip. I like it. So basically, you go explore the Great Salt Pond. It's got hidden coves. There's the oyster farms out there, the marinas. Andy's Way is great.
Yeah, it's super cool. And it's operated by and it's located adjacent to our friends at the BI Fishworks place.
Nice. All right. Well, you can hear everything we just talked about and more if you go to the BIFishworks.com or you can give them a call at 401-466-5392.
You know what my favorite thing to do on a paddleboard is?
What's that?
I like to bring a sandwich with me and paddle out to Andy's Way and just kind of camp out there and eat my sandwich.
It's like finding your own private spot.
I just try to not get sand in my sandwich.
Well, better in your sandwich than your shorts. That's my motto.
Yeah, good point. So I was just on the beach and saw Rich hanging 10 on a super cool surfboard rental from Diamond Blue Surf Shop. It's definitely the place to go for all your surfboard, paddleboard, and beach rental needs. But don't forget, Diamond Blue used to rent their stuff down on the beach, but this year you can go right to the shop for your rentals, where you'll also find the sweetest selection of swimsuits, hats, t-shirts, sandals, and other fun beach accessories. Be sure to check out their new line of Knockaround sunglasses. Knockaround is a super small, quality company that features polarized shades for under $40. They're available in tons of bright, fun colors and styles, so if you're looking for shades that are stylish, affordable, and fun, Diamond Blue can hook you up with a pair of Knockarounds and get you back out in the sun in no time. But don't forget to take care of that skin and put your sunscreen on. You don't have sunscreen? No worries, brah. Diamond Blue now features Vacation brand sunscreen. Based in Miami, Florida, Vacation sunscreen will let you spend all day on the beach without ever have to worrying about getting burnt. One of the greatest things about Diamond Blue is their owner and staff. Jen has owned and operated Diamond Blue for years now, and she only hires the most helpful, friendly crew of peeps who are filled to the brim with knowledge about all of Diamond Blue's fantastic products. Diamond Blue always has a ton of product, and there are even great deals to be found on last season's stuff. So get your buns in the sun and head down to Diamond Blue Surf Shop, located at the four-way intersection at Bridgegate Square. Hey, Rich, guess who I'm dressed as?
Let's see. You got crown, beard, trident. Are you a professional wrestler?
No, I'm King Neptune, duh.
Oh, sorry. King Neptune. Oh, you know what? The Neptune, that reminds me, I got some family coming out and they're going to stay up at the Neptune house.
Oh yeah, I love that place. They've got 23 modern condo style units, right?
Yeah, what's great is they've all got full kitchens with full size refrigerators. You know, maybe you don't want to eat out every night. You want to, you know, make something at home, or maybe you caught some fresh fish that day and you want to cook it on your own.
Right. You know what else? They've got great views and a heated pool, tennis courts, gas grills, picnic tables. They've even got a game room with a pool table for the kiddies.
Yeah, I mean, it's got everything you need to stay there and enjoy a great visit on Block Island. Sammy and the staff, they're always on hand. If you need anything, they're right there for you.
Sammy is so sweet and so nice. And you know what? The staff's great. And the best part is the location is awesome. You're tucked away from the hustle and bustle of downtown, but you're still a short walk to everything. The beaches, restaurants, you name it.
Yeah, I don't think there could be a better location. And, you know, they fill up quick in the summer, but the shoulder season is a great time to visit them as well. They rent spring and fall. Check their website, NeptuneHouse.com. Yeah, we're back with Dave Sniffen. Thanks, listeners, for supporting our sponsors.
Yes.
So, Dave, before we move on, because there's so much more to talk about with you, had you ever thought of maybe waking up an employee who was late by putting one of your snakes in the bed with them?
Ooh, that's a good idea.
You know, I mean, it would be very effective, but to be honest with you, I would worry about what would happen to the snake.
Yeah. They might start dating or something.
Wouldn't want the snake to get injured or anything by these crazy employees. Who knows what they're going to do? Fling it around the room?
Or maybe they just start snuggling with it.
Yeah, that would even worse.
Yeah. So, while they're getting high.
And before we move on from the restaurant thing, too, I do, you know, not we've been talking about how difficult it is, but I do remember a lot of really, you know, there's those years or those seasons where you have that crew dialed in and everyone's. It's that team, you know,
right.
And you have those nights where it's just clockwork, bang, bang. And then at the end of the night, everyone's at the bar having their shift drink, having a bunch of laughs. And that family vibe is, you really can't match that either. So it's just such an extreme.
People ask me all the time, do you miss the restaurant business? Yeah. That's one of the biggest questions I get. You miss being in the restaurant?
Me too.
And my answer is always no. I don't miss the restaurant business.
Right.
But what I do miss are the things exactly like you were just talking about. When you're with a crew and you're putting out the food and you're working, but it's just the night goes great and you put out a lot of great food and everybody's happy and you make these friends. Like I'm friends with people who I worked with in the 80s still in the restaurant business. And I'm still friends with a lot of the people who I worked with, you know, at the Mohegan and the Harborside and ran the kitchen here at Captain Nick's for a few years as well. And it helped at Club Soda. So you make those family memories with all these people and they last no matter what, which is kind of like people ask me about the Harborside because I worked there I can't even remember how many years, at least 12, 15 years. It was a long time.
Did you like bounce back and forth for Mike between the two places?
Exactly. Every day I'd start at the Harborside for breakfast in the morning, lunch at the Mohegan, and then back and forth for dinner service at Mohegan and Harbor Grill. You know, putting out fires, doing what you need to be done. But, you know, people ask me about that with the Harborside too. What, you know, it's a tragedy and the Harborside, the building's gone, but all your friends you made, all the memories you have, they're still there.
Yeah.
You know? Yeah. So that's not gone and that's not going to go away no matter what. And, you know, new building comes into place and more memories are made. But, you know, I don't miss the restaurant business in that respect, but I miss the people and I miss working hard with everybody. And when you say like you have that crew, that's your family, your second family, and you hang out with them outside of work and they become lifelong friends. That part of it, I definitely miss.
I just got in touch with, I was in touch with Peter and Joey last week because we were down in Florida. So those guys are doing good. Joey's carving his tikis.
I see. He's got on Facebook, all these telephone poles that he's carving.
He's carving into tikis with a chainsaw.
Crazy.
And Peter's still working that German joint.
Oh, yeah.
Still doing it for the guy.
All right.
Yeah.
I can't help but think that the world would be a better place if everybody had to do a couple of years in a restaurant.
I agree.
And you also lose the barriers of racism and religion and all that stuff because it doesn't matter. You know, you're in the front, you're in the lines with people, you know, you realize you're just working together.
All that matters is if you can do the job and, you're willing to do a job.
And not only half the time. Most of the time.
And so, all right, so you transition out of the restaurant business and what comes along next for you?
What comes along next is the, I heard that the towns, the Block Islands, the town of New Shoreham, that the recreation director position was coming open. And so I thought, I'll just apply for it and see what happens. And they called me and said, would you like the job? And it was it was kind of bittersweet for me because I'd been in the restaurant business for so long and I was working for Mark and Katie, and I didn't know, you know, what direction to go in, but I knew that I had to get out of the restaurant business just physically. I just couldn't do it anymore. And so I accepted the job, even though I had no idea really what I was doing. But it was a great decision for me health-wise.
But I have housing.
Yeah.
But
that was the big thing. That was, you're hired. Yeah. Do you have housing? Yeah, I have housing.
Yeah. Well, you've always been great with kids. You don't have kids of your own, but I've seen you with, you know, you're always there to, you would like kids to have fun. You like to help educate them.
You're like
fun
a
things.
Giant kid yourself. Yeah. I mean that in the best way. Mm-hmm. No, you do. You have a an innate curiosity about the world. And, you know, you're not laying them out right now. Maybe we can draw a few out, but you know, your one-liner, your jokes, we'll get to a joke
they're
section.
Classic.
They're
classic.
Kind of, there's a few, but anyway, it seemed to me, same thing. It seemed like a natural, you're a no-brainer.
Bit of a prankster too here and there.
A bit. A bit of a prankster.
I don't know what you guys are talking
potato
about.
Potato cannons?
Can we tell the...
I can tell a potato cannon story. That's a good one.
Can we tell the fish stomach story?
Can I tell that story?
I don't know, Kenny. I don't even know which one
I mean,
it is.
I think we can tell it.
All right. Well, I just hope that just my leave the names out. I'm going to tell my mother not to listen to this part of it if she's
well,
ever.
it's up to you. It's up to you.
So this goes back to the restaurant business, and my
you just use your words carefully. All right. Is how you describe. All right. What you know, you did.
Yeah. So this goes back to being in the restaurant, and
it's an all-time favorite of mine. Okay. I got to say,
every time we'd get in fish to clean. Especially like whole fish, like striped bass, or sometimes we'd get a whole halibut or whatever. I would get the fish out, or bluefish or anything, and I get the fish out and I start cleaning it, and I take the stomach and I'd always open up the stomach to see what it had been eating.
Yeah.
And I'd always call people up
like
from
in Jaws.
Yeah. I'd be like, hey, come check this out. Come check this out. This is what this guy had, like a squid in his stomach.
Yeah. Or a little lobster right.
I found. And crabs and stuff. Yeah. And they're like, everybody's like, yeah, that's pretty cool. and so. I did not realize that I did that so frequently that it became kind of a not a joke, but it, you know, people were like, he's always asking about fish stomachs. So you want to see what's in it.
Yeah.
So one day we got this particularly large striped bass in, and one of the lunch cooks was like, hey, when you clean that, can you just tell me let me know what it's eating? And I'm like,
probably a fisherman. He wanted to know what.
So,
you know.
So I'm like, I have a proud father moment there. I'm like, oh, they're learning. You know, I've given them this interest in science. They love this. They love this. You know what I've been doing. It's really paying off. I'm teaching them.
I'm breaking through to them.
Right. Yeah. Getting through to them. It's not just about going out at night and partying and everything. They're learning. So I get the fish out. And I tell the kid, hey, I'm going to clean the fish. And all of a sudden, like, everybody in the restaurant who's not working, not doing, they all come out to the back room to watch me clean the fish. And I'm like, this is great. You know, I'm science transferring over to work. I'm showing these guys these things. It's so cool. So I'm thinking, I'm the coolest. I slice open the stomach. I take the stomach out and it's gigantic. It's like got something in it. Huge stomach. And I'm feeling it. I'm like, what the heck? Is this a lure of some sort? And I'm like, it feels like a Coke bottle. Do you swallow a Coke bottle? So I take the stomach and I slice it open and I pull it out, and it's, I don't know how to say it on the...
It's a giant adult sex
toy.
Oh my God.
Anatomically correct, except for the size. And then everybody in the whole restaurant who'd come back to watch just start cracking up. They had pranked me pretty good. They put a sex toy down the gullet of the fish for me to find. So then we tied it to the back of Zena Clark's car. She drove around with it until it fell off. We don't know when it fell off somewhere.
That is up there on my list.
That was a humiliating story. That you know, it was, I thought I was getting through to these guys that they got me good. And I love the story. It's a great
story. But now why would they want to do that? Because I'm sure you never played any practical jokes on them.
We had a few things going on in the kitchen at all times. one time we had to make, the owners had to make a rule that you weren't allowed to light anybody else on fire. Because I used to do a prank with our lighters where I would come up behind somebody, especially when they were talking to somebody in deep conversation, and just click and do the little hot butt. Give them a little hot butt. And it became rampant throughout the staff, and people just, then you'd put a little paper doily in somebody's pocket and then light it on fire. The doily would go up, and it got to the point where we had to actually make a rule, no lighting people on fire, which I guess was probably the best.
Yeah, that's
it was a good eventually. It's a good rule. But,
good rule. You
know, it could turn into something bad eventually.
We used to do things to the wait staff, like we'd put a piece of bacon on their shoulder and see how long they'd go to table with a piece of bacon on their shoulder.
Or then, I clipped a lobster. I took the rubber band off and clipped it on someone's butt cheek once. I wasn't too happy with them, so I thought, what the heck?
The reason I brought up the potato cannon was because one day, and this is, I think I was still working mopeds. Like, this is way back. And I walked through the back alley, and there's Sniff with, like, this PVC, length of PVC tube that's all jerry-rigged together, and he's spraying WD-40 in the... I'm like...
It was ether. It was starting
ether.
Fluid.
Yeah. Really? I'm like, what the heck are you doing? He goes, it's a potato cannon. And I'm like, what do you mean? And he showed me what a potato... And then you...
That thing shot a lemon. I think it shot a lemon like a quarter of a mile.
It was insane.
That same potato cannon, I took it up to Club Soda. And when Eddie Berube and his partner, Johnny Patnaud, were just taking over the place. They are leasing it from the Ryans. And whatever corporation that was, they were leasing it from. And I brought the potato cannon up to show Eddie. I was like, I made this thing, check it out. And he's like, does it work? And I'm like, I think it works. We got to try it. So we jam a potato down the nozzle and we put the spray the ether in and we set it up and I'm holding it and I'm pushing the click button trying to get it to start and it's not doing anything. And we're like, what the heck's going on? And so I opened it up, I little more air into the chamber, and just as I'm about ready to pull the trigger, we were shooting at where the dumpsters were at Club Soda, there was a fence put up that, you know, like a wooden fence. And just as I'm getting ready to pull the trigger, the landlords pull up and I pull the trigger, and the thing explodes and shoots a potato through the fencing, shatters like four boards of the fencing, just destroys the front part, like three or four boards just get shattered in the fencing as the landlords pull up. And then I'm like, okay.
You know you're going to have to pay for that.
I was like, all right, I'll see you later. I left Eddie to deal with that stuff. But yeah, the potato cannon was a fun thing. I gave that to somebody when they used to have that, remember they used to have that, like, you build your own boat sailing competition and they see how they could sail it, like how far they could sail it, human powered. They did a thing for several years, and I lent it to someone because they were going to use it to sink other people's boats, and I never saw it after that. So it either got sunk or confiscated or something, but I don't know what happened.
The gadgets. Yeah, you're very crafty. And this isn't necessarily a gadget, but one of my favorite Dave Sniffen items that you made was, of course, your Monday night disco night mirror ball suit, disco ball suit, which was basically a suit with...
I got this idea. I don't know how it came about, but, you know, disco night is still huge, but it was huge when I was younger and I would go to the disco nights, and I just got this idea. How could you be like a disco ball? How could you dress like a disco ball? And I got this idea. I went to a thrift store.
Yeah.
And bought a black suit. Just cheap. I think it was like $10. And then I went to a lamp and mirror store in Providence, and they had these sheets of mirror that were 1x1 squares. And they were 144 for each sheet. And I think I bought like 10 sheets of that. And then one winter when I wasn't working, I spent cutting the squares out and gluing them onto the jacket and the vest and the tie and some shoes and made this.
And the pants, too.
And the pants. The pants were pretty uncomfortable, although they did give you a good line. When you go up to somebody, you'd be like, look at your pants with the mirrors, and you go, hey, I can see you in my pants.
There's one.
There it is.
That's one of the lines.
So that was a good line.
I just remembered you and I did a costume together. Remember that for Halloween?
I love Halloween and I love the costumes, and I would always do something try to do something outlandish and usually gory or something like that. One year I brought I had a 12-foot shark I made out of foam that I was a shark attack victim, and I had like severed limbs and guts sticking out and stuff like that. And that was fun. But yeah. Rich and I did a costume where he was like the mad doctor and I was in a shopping cart and
we made it look like a gurney.
We cut out a piece of plywood to cut on the top so my legs would stick out, my body would be under, my head would and chest would stick out. And then we made a false body that I filled with.
We ordered real liver and all real organs.
I had a beef heart. I had livers. I made intestines out of red Jello.
Yeah, and, had to make the intestines. They wouldn't
out sell. Of sausage. Yeah. I made it out of sausage casing and red Jello and beef ribs from a prime rib. And had like an open heart surgery, and I mean it was.
Did you guys win? Was there a prize?
Oh, we won.
Want to hear the great part about the win?
Yeah,
top prize: $100 gift certificate to the Mohegan.
Yeah,
I was like, oh, that's great.
Yeah,
I was like, I won't be using that.
Yeah. Have you seen the kitchen there?
Yeah. All right, so I went backwards. Sorry, but
that was a great costume.
We were getting on to your new
the new gig.
Oh, the new gig.
So you apply, you had housing, so they gave you the job.
Right. Mm-hmm. And it turned out it's a great job. I love it. I work with every part of Block Island society. We have a pickleball program that benefits everybody, but we have a lot of senior citizens who participate in that. I've got an indoor soccer program tonight that has, it usually has between 10 and 20 participants who come in and play soccer. In the summer, I have great programs. I've got a softball program, a beach volleyball, a soccer program. And then, I have a soccer program with the kids where we play soccer every day. So it's great. And it's, it's a lot less debilitating. And 40 hours a week is kind of...
Yeah, it's kind of nice,
kind of weird.
Yeah.
Kind of weird.
You still probably with this, you have to work a few nights.
I work Friday nights. I don't mind any of that.
No.
Last night I had... of programs for the kids. We had kids, grade 7 through 12 in the gym last night, from 8 to 10, there was kids playing in the gym last night. So,
and you do now, you organize the road race, the triathlon?
We do three races. We do the Shad Bloom in the spring. We do the triathlon in August, which is a huge race. We have about 400 people in it this year. Great race. And then we do a half marathon in October.
Yeah. And were those were all pre-existing before you got there? Or
no, not the half marathon. We started the half marathon.
Is that a ton of work to organize and put? Or, you've got it.
It's
down
getting
now.
Easier. It gets easier every year. Now it's getting easier. It's a lot of work. The triathlon's a lot of work too, but it helps benefit our program because the rec department, because it generates income for the rec department so that we can keep the taxpayer costs down low for our budget. We also run the town beach in the summertime.
Right.
That's what I was going to say. Yeah.
About three or four summers ago at the beginning of the season, I was in desperate need of a beach umbrella and none of the ones that I've found, there are all those chintzy little, toothpick things that look like they go in a cocktail.
Yeah.
So I went over and saw Dave and he sold me a sweet secondhand used one from a few seasons ago. I still have it.
Yeah, it's a good one.
You can't kill it. Those things are diesel.
That's why we use them.
Diesel.
Yep. They're awesome.
So you do have a tax. There is a budget from the town.
Right. That's one of the things that was always weird to me. Like, I'm responsible for the budget. I have to put forth a budget to the town manager and the finance department, and then it has to get approved by the town council, but ultimately approved by the townspeople in the financial town meeting.
Do they allow the revenue you make from the races and stuff? Does that go into your budget, or does that have to go back into the general fund and then it's factored into your next budget?
It doesn't matter, but it helps offset our budget. The town beach has a good amount of income, but it also has large costs associated with it. We hire lifeguards and managers and things like that. So, the dollars and cents parts of it, that comes in as revenue from the rec department.
Right. So. Right. Yeah. It's one of the few departments that has revenue, really.
Right. Harbors has a huge
Harbors. Harbors. I was going to say that's the other one.
And then the building department has revenue from permits and stuff like that.
Now, do you get a lot of volunteers?
Yeah, that's great. One thing that's great about Block Island is that I have a lot of people who come and volunteer because, and I don't know, not because of, but they also participate in some of our programs, like some of our pickleball players. They're like, hey, we'll come help you out at your race. And, you know, other people who've participated in programs from will come and help. You know, it's great. You know, it's great to get that amount of support from the island.
So if anybody's listening and you want to volunteer, they can reach out to you and leave a message on your business line down at the town hall. Do you have an office at the town hall?
I do.
Oh, nice. Is it fancy?
I'm not fancy, so the office is not fancy.
Would they let you keep a snake in there?
Probably not, but they wouldn't know.
You haven't asked, right?
I'm at the far end. You don't know if you don't ask.
Yeah.
I'm at the far, far end of the town hall, away from where I can do the least amount of damage, I think. Far end.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so is this a gig you see, you're happy with it? You see yourself doing this for a while?
I do. I've never liked the 9-to-5. I've never liked to sit in front of a computer or sit in an office. That's never been me. So I like my job is, I don't know what it's going to take every day. Some days I have to do something and I have to go fix something at the town beach, or I have a program. Like tonight I have programs, for soccer players, and tomorrow I have toddler time in the morning, AM, 9 AM. We have open the gym for little kids to come in and play, and then older kids after that. So it's good. It keeps me moving, keeps me motivated. I'm not sitting around.
Yeah.
I see you on a tractor sometimes.
Sometimes.
Yeah.
Yeah. Sometimes I come up at Heinz Field. That's another part of ours. We maintain Heinz Field, drive the tractor around, dig up the base paths of the softball diamond and get that ready and that kind of thing.
Well, a lot to it. I think it's a good deal. Do you ever run into any, I know there used to be some bones of contention with programs that would start up for kids because it would draw them away from other things at like regular sports and schools. Do you run into any stuff like that?
Not really, because we work hand in hand with the school, and particularly I concentrate most of my programming to grades around grade 5 or 6. When they get into 6th grade and 7th grade, 8th grade, they start doing, like junior high, high school, they do that's through the school. But I kind of take care of the younger kids before they get up into the high school. So we try not to compete. It's a little different. On the mainland, that a lot of departments are dealing with that all the time because everybody wants their kid to go to the NBA or wants their kid to, become a professional sports player. So they're putting them in these highly competitive leagues or travel teams and things like that. So that draws away, but we don't have that draw out here. But like places like Narragansett are definitely having issues like that, where they don't have enough kids for a program, for like a basketball program, because all the kids are going to travel teams and, camps and things like that. So, But Block Island, a little different. We don't have that much pressure on that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's really wild. My nephew played hockey and lacrosse, and it's not like when we were kids. Like I played church league baseball, and it was like you had one or two practices and then you have a game a week. Now it's like practice 6 days a week, and then you're traveling 3 hours to tournaments, and it's intense.
Right.
Oh yeah. It's now it's like 2 weeks before Labor Day, you can see the island emptying out.
Yeah.
It used to be you just finish up the summer and you get in the car and go home and go to school. And now if you play on a sports team, they want you there like middle of August, August, 20th.
And that's one of the big changes out here for me as far as employees are concerned, especially like lifeguards and things like that. I hire a lot of college students, and they all have to leave mid-August now, and that's tough,
Yeah, and how long do we keep our beach manned with lifeguards? Just till Labor Day?
Till Labor Day, and then we keep the beach house itself open for bathrooms till Columbus Day.
Yeah,
but that's a lot longer than it used to be. In the past, it was just shut down completely at Labor Day. But it's nice to have bathrooms at least for people walking the beach and stuff like that.
Do you ever use reruns of Baywatch as like a training video for the lifeguards?
One of my famous lines for them is that it's not like Baywatch. You're not going to break up a drug deal 1 minute and then rescue 20 drowning orphans at the next. It's not like Baywatch at all. And I try to tell them that. And I also try to tell them that that's a good thing. You don't want to be rescuing everybody every 30 seconds. You know, if you go through your whole season without a rescue, that's a very successful season. Yeah. We don't want to rescue people. We want them to not get in trouble. And that starts by, our lifeguards keeping an eye on things and not letting things go to that length. So,
yeah.
Yeah.
hope they don't take that the wrong way. I think that person's drowning. Yeah, but Dave said we don't want to rescue them.
I didn't say don't rescue them.
You know, you just don't want to see them. No, I don't want to see
it.
Prevention.
Just don't look like David Hasselhoff while you're doing it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, I tried to convince them all to run down the beach in slow motion, but they didn't. they couldn't get it right.
It's an acquired skill. Yeah, you got to work on that. What else we got? We're getting close to the time-ish, but we got any other hot topics?
What do you got for us?
I don't got, well, I mean, I got stuff, but I don't know if you want to talk about it. I do have a great Tommy Mahoney story.
Let's hear it.
I got two great Tommy Mahoney stories.
Yes, please.
I do have, everybody knows Tommy Mahoney. He's a legend in his own mind. But
been a podcast guest.
And he's awesome. And I think he gave me a little shout out and his podcast. So I wanted to give him a little shout out and tell the story of, we coined a new phrase. It's called getting Mahoney'd. And so back in the day, Club Soda, there was a bartender by the name of Chris Kelly. And he was all excited one day because it's kind of normal now. But back then, Jägermeister came out with a tap machine. It was a machine. Yeah. You plug it in. It had to put the three bottles on top, and you had Jägermeister on tap.
Chilled
the entire time. And this was Club Soda got one, and he was very excited about it. So I was there for dinner. It's probably like around 8 o'clock. I went in for dinner and I'm sitting at the bar and we see Tommy Mahoney pull up. So Chris Kelly's like, want to mess with Mahoney? And I'm like, yeah. So
of course. Yeah. What kind of a question is that?
So Tommy comes in, sits down. Chris comes up to me, goes, here's the plan. I'm going to tell Tommy, because when you bought the machine, you got like three free bottles of Jägermeister. So Eddie and Johnny, the owners of the bar, were like, you can give some shots away, you know,
get promoted.
Goodwill promoted.
That's the idea. Yeah.
And so he says, I'm going to pour Tommy a shot of Jägermeister, you and I a shot of Pepsi, and we're just going to do shots all night.
Oh, boy.
So it starts out. Tommy's excited, gets shot, and then, you know, next shot, and it just kept going and going and going. We thought we were going to get, you know, he'd figure it out, you know. I don't know how many shots in. I'd say probably 12 to 15 shots in towards the end of the night. Suddenly, Tommy realizes somehow that he's been hoodwinked. And
great word.
Tommy, you know, who's... you know, had 12 or 14 shots of Jägermeister, he gets his Jägermeister enragement going, and he jumps up and I fear for my life at this point. I think he's going to kill me. And you know, Club Soda is a circular bar. I'm running around the circular bar. Tommy's chasing behind me.
Chasing
me around the island. And Chris Kelly's there. And he's like, as I'm running by, he's like, get him outside as fast as you can. So then I see Chris jump over the bar and run outside. I'm like, he left me. So I'm like, oh. So I'm like, I'm running. Tommy's hot on my heels, trying to kill me. I run out the doors. Chris Kelly's out there. He has like one of those wooden window flower pots full of flowers, and he just smashes Tommy on the head with
it. Did it break?
Shattered. And Tommy's on the ground, and it's like the cartoons that you see, like the flower on the top of the head sticking up bent, and it's like almost you see like birds flying around him and stuff. He's out. So then we're just stopping and we're like realizing the gravity of what we've just done.
You're like, did we kill him?
Not only did we alcohol poison him, but now we've concussed him as well. And we're like, what do we got to do? So we're like, we can't leave him here. So Chris Kelly gets his pickup truck.
I think the word is you shouldn't leave him here.
So we somehow throw him in the back of the pickup truck, and he was living above, behind the beachhead. He had an apartment with a couple of people up there. So we get him home. And we're like, we can't, I don't want to put him in his bed.
Yeah.
So we put him in the bathtub. We figured if he got sick or something, at least he'd be in the bathtub. So then I go the next morning to check on him, and I drive up, and they'd been doing some like landscaping work, and there's a big pile of dirt in the yard, and all of Tommy's clothes are laid out in the dirt. And I go in to check on Tommy, and he's in bed, and he's holding a giant log, sleeping with this giant log, completely naked. And we come to find out, like, we hung out there, and he finally woke up, and he's like, yeah, I lost control of all of my bodily functions and just totally lost it and went and laid out in the dirt pile and got sick and everything else, and then took the log to bed with him for some reason. He didn't really know why. He brought the log
like
to bed.
Like a teddy log.
So we almost killed him. You know, but he said, you know,
he's tough to kill.
Yeah, he's tough to kill. Yeah. So he, you know, determined Well, I know. Yeah. So he basically coined the phrase, you know, now that if you get somebody so drunk that they lose control of all of their bodily fluids and then wake up with a log in their bed, then they've been Mahoney.
Oh, wow.
Okay.
So,
yeah. Wow.
I like it.
I mean, that was crazy. I couldn't believe it. I still don't believe it's actually happened. Like, got knocked out with a flower pot, but 100% true. Crazy. Well,
the good old days.
Yeah. And then he stole some stuff. He got back at us, though. He stole one of the guy's Cadillacs that was parked out front. And, like, we'd come in to check on him. And then he got up and he ran out the door and jumped in the Cadillac and drove away, like, giving us the finger. And we jumped in another car and followed him. And he drove it right onto where the boat was loading, drove it right onto the ramp, jumped out, took the keys and ran away. So then
next level, right?
So we show up and the boat guys are all standing there like,
whose car is this?
Yeah. Yeah. And the guy whose car it was says, that's my car. I'm like, well, move it. And he's like, I don't have the keys. I don't know where the keys are. And they're like, you got to move it. And he's like, I don't have keys. I don't know where the keys are. So they had to get the forklifts and move it off the ramp.
Probably isn't great for the car.
It was like a 75 blue Cadillac arc thing. But,
oh my God. That's hilarious.
That's a pretty good get back.
Wow. Yeah.
Wow.
Lesson learned.
I can tell you the story of the best April Fool's joke I ever got done to me, though.
Sure.
Okay.
With John Foster. You guys know John Foster?
Oh, yeah.
So John and I, he worked at the Atlantic when I was there, and we became very good friends. And we're still friends. I just don't really see him much anymore. But it was April Fool's Day, and he showed up at the Mohegan for lunch or later in the afternoon, and he was like, I went out to say hello to him. Hey, John, what's going on? He goes, oh, I've been driving all day. He was driving a taxi. He had a taxi called Minuteman Taxi.
I remember.
They
first phone in a taxi.
They drove all over the place. So anyway, he shows up. He said, oh, I'm starving. I can't wait. I'm going to order a burrito. Make it nice for me. And I said, I'll put enough cheese in it to choke a goat. You know, you'll be all set. So as soon as I go back in to make his burrito, I go to the phone in the office and I dial up and I'm like, can I get a cab at the Manassees? And I see John like jump up. He was really responsive to cab. So he jumps up and runs out the door. He tells the bartender, I'll be back. And he goes up to the Manassees. And then no one there knows that he doesn't need a cab. You know, he's like up there for like 10 minutes. He finally comes back down and I let him know. I pranked him. You know, I was like, April Fools, I got you good. So I didn't expect, like, I expected a little retribution, but I didn't expect what was coming.
What a setup.
That makes it great.
So I drove at the time a Jeep Eagle wagon and roll down windows. You had to crank roll them down and everything like that. And I went out that night to Club Soda, got some dinner. John was there. And then I was going to go out and I'll go home and shower, clean up, and then go out, meet some people out and stuff. So I get in my car and the weirdest thing, like the seats like slid way back and the window handles are missing. They're off my car. And I'm like, what is going on here? And I open my glove compartment and there are the window handles. And they have like a special like torque wrench that you're supposed to put on.
Yeah.
So I kind of try to slide my seat forward, but it doesn't really slide forward. So anyway, I drive home and I'm like, I actually had those wrenches at my house. So I put the handles back on. I'm like, good one, John, you got me, because, you know, nobody has those wrenches, these special wrenches. And I actually had bought them to remove them at some point. So I'm like, oh, he got me good. So I go upstairs, I sit down on my bed and I'm like, man, the house just reeked of, like, I was staying at a house on the west side for the winter and it just smelled. I'm like, I got to talk to the landlord. I think there's a sewer line backup or something. I'm like, I gotta get out of here. So I shower and get in the car, drive to, I forget where, I went out to Captain Nick's and Yellow Kittens. Long night out, great night out. I'm like, I get home, go to bed. I wake up the next morning, I'm like feeling terrible. I drank too much, you know? So I go outside and I get in the car, the seat's way back and the handles are missing from my car.
I'm like, again.
I'm like, John, come on. So I look, lift up the glove compartment, open it up. The handles aren't in there. So now I'm like, it's like, I'm feeling horrible. My head's pounded and the seat's so far back. I slide it forward. And as I slide it forward, I hear a little like a cracking noise. And all of a sudden my car fills with rotten egg sulfur smell. Fart bomb. They make them. They make these stink bombs, these little glass vials.
Old glass ones, yeah.
And I shattered them. So I'm like, oh, I go to roll down the windows. I can't roll down the windows. Driving with my head out the window, trying to, you know, without the, out the door, opening the door. He had not only, he did it the first time, but the first time it didn't break, like the night before.
It jammed.
It didn't break, so I didn't notice it. And then he put them underneath my bed between the box spring and the frame. He'd put them on my bed at my house. So when I got home and sat down on my bed, it shattered them. And then that just leaked all over the place, and my house just reeked. And then the perfect timing was the next morning when I couldn't roll down the windows to get rid of the smell. And yeah, that was, I called him up. I'm like, I won't ever prank you again.
You know what's, no, he's crafty.
He got me good.
Oh yeah.
You know what's funny is that I recall there was a number a long time ago, like maybe around this time, when here at Nick's, someone kept dropping those things off, you know, lighting those off or breaking them in Nick's. And everyone was like, oh, what the hell, people clear out? We never could figure out who it was. I'm not saying it was John, but
I don't know who it was, but that. It wasn't me.
I cracked a few in my school.
Oh, my God. Those ones, the ones in the glass.
Little glass bottles. Yeah. Yep.
They were bad.
They were bad, yeah.
And you could put it down, and like as soon as the bell would ring and the classes would change, it would just get stepped on. Like, you were at the other end of the gym by the time it went off at the library. Like,
that was the genius of John with the bed frame especially. You know, he knew I was going to sit on my bed at some point or get in bed. And then he knew I couldn't roll my windows down in my car. And that was another form of hell, you know. Oh, it was brutal.
Brutal.
But good,
man.
Good. I like it. It was a good one. I got to use him as a resource to if I need to get even with someone.
It was good, though. I got to give him credit on that.
Well, what do you think? Should we wrap it up?
I guess so. It's getting to be that time.
Fun conversation, though, Dave. Yeah. Thanks so much.
Yeah.
Thanks, Dave.
Really appreciate it.
Definitely. And, it definitely went in tangents. I didn't think it was going to go.
Oh, that's how we roll.
This whole thing's
getting together again and going a different tangent, you know?
Yeah.
But we're running out of time for this episode. Thank you, listeners, for listening to us and the tangents of Dave Sniffen. We probably
helped.
If you want to reach us or give us any advice, we may not take it, but it's twoguysonbi@gmail.com.
Yeah, and if you're into the social media thing, check us out on the old Facebook and the Instagram. And most importantly, wherever you're listening to the podcast, please subscribe. And even more important than that, just tell your friends about it and share it with them.
Yeah, and thanks. We'll see you again next time.
All right, thanks.
Well, we won't see you.
Well, we won't. Yeah, you'll hear us. Yeah,
but we won't talk. Yeah,
a lot.
That's it.
Okay,
that's what we do.
See you next week, or 2 weeks.
Okay.
Hey, Rich.
What's up?
I want to go build a potato cannon. Do you have any potatoes?
Yeah, I do. They're a little small.
All right.
Maybe we could expand them with a little stink bomb.
Ooh, that's... Can we...
Do you put a stink bomb inside the potato?
So it's a stinky potato cannon.
I think that would work.
All right. Let's get sniffing on this.
Stink cannon.
All right. We'll call up Dave.
It's a great nickname for someone.
Oh, and one last thing. Whether you're a local or just visiting Block Island, pick up a copy of the Block Island Guide. Published annually for the last 35 years, it features 120 pages full of killer photos and all the details you need to know. Most importantly, it's fun to read. What shall we do with Drunken Sailor? What shall we do with Drunken Sailor? What shall we do with Drunken Sailor? We'll die in the morning.